Hello, you're listening to Flix West Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and upgrading the conversation is the one and only Marcus Pinn. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So, usually we talk about films that aren't so recent on the podcast, but today we're making an exception to talk about Lee Whannell's 2018 film Upgrade. So, I don't usually do this, but I'm going to give people a heads up that we're going to get into spoilery talk just because it's a brand new film and people still might want to be surprised by its twists and
That was a
turns,
good
but
point. If I just want to jump in and interject too. This is kind of like, on Repo Man level, like video store type word of mouth, where it's just like now that it's streaming, I feel like that's a lot of the attention it's getting because I did not see this movie in the theater, and I don't know too many people who saw it in the theater either. I saw it on a good television, but I'm still kicking myself. Like I wish I had the means to just like the disposable income to just like rent out a theater and watch this on the big screen because I really loved this movie. It's probably the only, and it wasn't even in my top 10, but it's just like it's such a rewatchable movie. It's probably the only 2018 movie I watched multiple times.
I think when it came out, there might have been something big in the theater or like a couple big things, and it sort of just slipped through the cracks a little bit. And if you just read the basic synopsis, like the log line for the film, it sounds very direct to video-y. Like I remember a lot of post Terminator, post RoboCop films I would rent from the video store. It has a little bit of that sound to it if you hear the synopsis, which is this man, Gray Trace, which to the credit of the film doesn't feel silly when they say it in the movie, but his name's Gray Trace and he lives in the near future. His wife is murdered and he's paralyzed, and then he's given this incredible computer that relays his mind to his body and can control his body and make him walk again and do things again. And he sets out with this computer to get revenge on the people who killed his wife. It sounds very stock, and in some ways, the basic spine of it is stock, but it's more in the details and that sort of thing that I feel like the film is more than maybe you expect it to be.
Exactly. Well, and this is going to sound weird and contradicting. It's like more than you expect it to be, but it's also to some degree everything you think it is, 'cause just like the stuff you especially wrote, I mean, it's literally like a man is injured, presumably dead. They operate on him and they make him into this machine. It's been done so many times. But there is something about the execution of this where, like, for example, earlier you talked about being in, the near future where there's like this movie isn't not it's not like Back to the Future. It's not like lace up sneakers and hoverboards. There's just like cool little small pieces of technology. The cars are kind of sleek, but then it's just like, Gray Trace specifically. It's almost like a Bruce Willis in Fifth Element where it's just like he's the modern guy who just hasn't adapted to all this, new technology. I mean, just his character is introduced. He's working on like an old car. You know what I mean? And even, like even the other characters in the movie, especially, I forgot his name, the mad scientist, he actually dresses a little more futuristic, and whatnot. But it's
Aaron, who's kind of like the Elon Musk, Zuckerberg
Definitely,
sort of
definitely.
surrogate type character. But then you see people who live in ways that aren't that futuristic, like when he's hunting down the people in this gang who paralyzed him. Like it looks like present day home when he's sneaking in and sneaking around. But by contrasting that with some of the more futuristic stuff, instead of just feeling like, hey, we're going to shoot the present day and be sort of lazy about it, by picking and choosing when to introduce these sci-fi elements, it actually fleshes out the world instead of it feeling like, hey, we don't have much of a budget, even though I think it was a pretty small budget. What was it? Like they said, $3 to $5 million. I mean, most of the Blumhouse movies do, but usually it's like a ghost running around inside of a house kind of a story.
But it's a little slick because if you notice, it's only like, sure, like there's some scenes where they're driving on the highway, but for the most part, like most critical scenes are just like we just needed a warehouse, we needed a rundown building, we needed so like it's one of those things too where like I'm not a filmmaker, so I always cringe when I say stuff like this, but it's like part of it is just like make it look good, like a movie, and I feel like part of the job is done to some degree.
I think so. I like a lot of it seems, they stick a geometric pattern on the wall and that's all you need to make the house feel a little bit more science fiction or futuristic. Like, they're selective in how they do it. They're careful in the production design, and they kind of make a small budget go a long way, you know. And really, the cast is pretty small. There's not that many speaking roles in the whole film.
I was just getting ready to say, also.
The director, I saw a video where he was talking about being inspired by films like RoboCop, Terminator, Cube, Videodrome, and he talked about the idea of making an achievable sci-fi film with practical effects and scale, and this idea that you don't necessarily have to have a big budget to tell a story. And, you know, RoboCop and Terminator both good examples of that, where you have this sort of bigger story that's funneled into something that feels very, you know, let's go and shoot in a factory kind of a movie.
Well, Cube also, that, that more than, I mean, RoboCop and Terminator, even though there's a lot of isolated moments, that's still ambitious.
And there's still, and
whereas like Cube is just straight up, I mean, like it like it's mostly, if I'm not mistaken, that is a set, right?
Yeah, and it's just one set. You know, when they go from room to room, they would change the lighting to kind of feel like there are multiple rooms, you know, when they open any door and go in any direction. But like Vincenzo and Natalie, I think they just had the one set. And, you know, that's a very slick film and how it stretched a budget. That had a tiny budget, like I think maybe only a couple thousand dollars, like less than $1 million budget, and it has a scope to it that exceeds the actual production values.
Absolutely.
Which Upgrade, like, again, they sort of find creative ways to do that, and that's one thing I like about it, is just when they find a place to slip in something that makes you rethink what this world's like. It's in the writing, it's in the production design, it's in the performances. You know, one moment I was thinking about is when he's paying the hacker formerly known as Jamie, and they're surprised to see paper money, and you sort of realize, oh, like this world, paper money almost doesn't exist. Everyone's paying with, you know, cards or PayPal type stuff, or, you know, it's all digital. And the hacker also comments that, like, oh, it really does say God on the money. Like it's just such a like a strange moment, because it sort of makes you think, you know, what is this world actually like? And, you know, in some ways, how, even though it looks very similar to the way we live now, it also feels like there are these jumps that do make it futuristic.
And, you know, also one thing that really goes, I don't want to say unnoticed, but unnoticed enough, is like the score.
Yeah,
especially if you have a good system or if you have some really good headphones. This is something, maybe not exactly, but in terms of, like, the care that I guess I feel, this is almost something that, like, you know, something that would be, like, in a Christopher Nolan film or, like, a Darren Aronofsky movie. Like, this, it's such a grand score, though. Like, I don't know.
No, like, I mean, that's something I remember hearing David Cronenberg talk about, how if your film's low budget and kind of small scale, it's okay to go a little bit bigger on the score as a way to almost, not as a cheat, but like as a way to make it feel bigger than it actually is, you know, and it kind of adds a sense of grandeur.
I don't mean to cut in, but you just reminded me too, because it's like, you did mention Videodrome, but outside of Videodrome, stuff like, you know, like The Brood and even Scanners is going back to what you were saying before. It was just like sci-fi movie with big ambitions, but it's still like, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but I mean that in a good way. It's just like, there's not a huge budget, and like it's still, you know, he still pulled it off. You know, he pulled it off.
Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, somebody works in film, like, I find that more interesting and more encouraging, because you have to be actually creative instead of just throwing piles and piles of money at it. And, like, you know, there's also sort of a Cronenberg influence in a little bit of the body horror in the film, and, you know, people fusing with machines. That's a very Cronenberg idea.
Oh, absolutely.
Even when they go into that bar with the bones decorating it all over, it sort of associates these people upgrading it associates the like mechanical implants with body mod culture, you know. It kind of puts it in that territory too, so again, it's connecting something from today to a sort of futuristic idea. Like, instead of, you know, just getting something for cosmetic qualities, you know, they have guns built into their hands and they have, you know, things like that, but they're all kind of hanging out at the same bar, and it all feels like it's part of the same subculture.
Sure.
Yeah.
We'll get to those guys later, because the villain is, I don't want to jump ahead, but I have so much to say about that guy. But
if you want to talk about the performances, I guess probably the best place to start with the performances is with the lead, Logan Marshall Green, who I'd seen him kind of here and there. He shows up in Prometheus, and I hadn't really thought too much of him, which I feel bad now because, it, like, you know, I think just the films I had seen him in weren't necessarily good showcases for his abilities as an actor.
Strangely enough, he actually, so it's funny you say that. He is one of those, like, New York actors that has been on, like, every iteration of a Law & Order.
Right. I was looking at his IMDb, and there's, like, a bunch of Law & Order credits.
But there's one specific. It's a really cool twist where it's just, like, he's this kind of, like, poor kid from the wrong side of the tracks, and he's, like, in college now, and he's hanging out with all these, like, rich kids, and then this girl gets, like, raped and murdered. And then you think it's all these, like, rich, spoiled college kids, but that at the end of the day, it turns out it was him, and he had, like, a back history. Like, when he was 10 years old, he killed this 5-year-old kid, but because he was 10, it was, like, expunged from his record. And then, like, as the episode progresses, he just gets more and more and more sociopathic, and it's just like, oh, this is a really good, he gave a really good performance. It's weird. Law & Order, especially SVU, this was an SVU episode. Right. Every once in a while, Law & Order pulls out, like, Martin Short, Isabelle Huppert, Jeremy Irons. They've had some really random great guests who really just kind of hit a home run. And I thought, and like Logan Marshall Green, the way that the episode ends kind of on an open note, because they're like, you know, just tell us what you did with the body. And he's just like, huh, I don't know. And then just the episode ends. Like, so the family gets no closure. Yeah, he just like, and he walks off to do life in prison. And he's just like, damnedest thing, I completely forgot. And then he just like, wow.
I mean, you can see a little bit of that range in his performance in this film, because I almost forget that, like, he's doing twice as much work as you see, because he's playing, first of all, like, you know, this character, but he's also playing the way the computer controls his body. There's like a great physical performance going on there. And then like at the end, I guess maybe now's a good time to spoil it. The computer eventually takes over his body, and he does have that sort of switch to, you know, oh, like there's a machine behind this person's eyes. It's not this warm character you've grown to know.
I've been like watching interviews of him, like on the festival premiere circuit, and just even him, I'm not trying to like, you know, it's not like I have a man crush, or maybe I do, but like he has this like, he's got this like quiet charisma to him.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'm surprised I don't see him more regular. I, you know, whatever. I guess he's not like the leading, a leading man, but I just figure he'd show up, you know, in more stuff. Like he'd be a good villain. Going back to what I was talking about in that SVU episode.
Yeah, like I mean, in this he does sort of become the villain by the end. And again, spoiler warning, but
all right.
Like when the
I was for a second, I was like, what are you talking about? Oh yeah,
like, yeah.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Like when the STEM computer finally takes it over, like, I almost forget that's him as an actor doing that performance. I'm like, oh, well, Logan Marshall Green's checked out. It's just the computer.
Which is great. Left. And it's also quietly a testament to good physical acting, too. Because just moments
his
where he has to do it himself.
Acting like, is just like off the charts of this film. Like, it's almost so good. You again, like, kind of forget that he's doing it all, and it's easy to overlook. Like, the fight scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, really sort of creative approach. First of all, the choreography is great, where he's dodging punches and
well, I was getting ready to say really a great combination rigid, of like the very first, you know, where he finds, you know, the first guy, he goes to that bad neighborhood where he's coming into his own body. It's like great choreography and cool action and martial arts, but it's also this like Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin, Marx Brothers. That's like, I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, but his physical acting is so great, because he's just like, what am I doing? But his limb movements are really cool. Still not fully there yet, which is the point. And exactly. It's just really, really, really great. Yeah.
I really like, you know, he's kicking ass, and at the same time, he's turning his head away from the action, and he's just like saying "what the fuck" over and over again, and like, "what am I?" What, you know, he looks like he's a passenger in his own body, which is the effect that you want, and it's all just down to his performance. Yep. So, like, that's really incredible that he can nail that choreography, which is stylized because he has these sort of robotic movements, which they're not rigid, like they're smooth, but they're very linear. His arm extends out of the way, his posture is very straight, and at the same time, you know, his expression on his face, it's shocked when he's stabbing this person. You know, it's like he doesn't have control over his body. So I was really, really impressed with this physical performance, and I like how the action is paced throughout the film. There aren't really that many action scenes, even though it's sort of, you know, sci-fi action.
You're right.
Dark sci-fi action movie. You know, there's that first fight he has with the guide where it's like him realizing what his, you know, new computerized body is capable of. Then you have him fighting a group of people, and then towards the end, it's him fighting the one of the villains who is also sort of upgraded like he is. So it's, you know, it's almost like that martial arts movie structure where it's like, oh, you know, first it's one-on-one, and then it's one against a group, and then it's one against like a equal opponent or superior opponent.
And,
so,
and as a sub, as a little subcategory with that, he's coming with each fight, he comes into his ability to hurt people more. Like the first, like we just talked about, the first one, he's like, ah, he's got a knife, I don't know what I'm doing. And then the second one, when he's at the bar and he takes out all those guys, he's comfortable beating the shit out of people. But when he has to stab the guy multiple times, like in the neck and face, he, like you said, he has to look away.
Yeah.
And then the next one, it's like with each one, he's like more comfortable with gore as each fight goes on also.
Like, you know, we said he sets out for revenge, but really he's persuaded into it. And you can notice that more when you watch the film on a second viewing, how, you know, at first he just kind of wants to die when he wakes up. He doesn't really want...
Sure.
You know, what he says to the guy who offers him this implant, this computerized implant, like, I'm looking for the off switch. I'm not looking for a new life.
Sure.
And then Aaron Keane, he says... what would she want? And that's what sets him on this revenge path.
Right.
But, you know, it's sort of like he's, you know, a little bit tricked into thinking it's his own decision, you find out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's this computer pushing him further and further along that path. And, you know, again, making him more comfortable with the violence, the gore. It actually sort of gently persuades him, subtly persuades him in that direction constantly. And, you know, you find out that he's actually on the course of this grander plan.
I do just have to say, I won't say a whole lot until the end, but I will say, because there's little rumors and talks, you know, of a sequel. I mean, movie articles these days, it'll just be like a producer will say one thing, like a producer will say, like, I'd be interested in doing a sequel, and then the next headline is there's going to be a sequel. So it's like,
it's announced,
you know.
Yeah.
But I will say, if they do a sequel, and that's kind of up in the air, the sequel writes itself. They don't need to do anything extra. And again, by the end of the episode, we'll get to it. But still, the sequel, it writes itself. And I'm curious to what you think. It is slight. It's obviously, there's two open ends, and we'll talk about it again. But I do have to interject midway and just be like, the sequel's right there. They don't have to do anything extra or special. But I'm sorry. But go ahead.
Right. I think one of the smartest things they could do if they made a sequel is not give it a budget bigger than the first one.
Oh, I without question. Look, all right, I'll just have to say, look, I apologize, but it's just like, he walks on, and you know, Cortez, she's not dead, and obviously now they have to do the procedure on her, and now she has to go after him. She's now the good guy.
It would be her waking him up inside his own fantasy world.
I mean, we can get into the
ending.
Wasn't
we don't
thinking that. Oh,
oh, okay.
Oh, that's
stuff. Well,
oh, I wasn't even going I wasn't going that deep. But okay. I wonder if they can do it. Oh, wow.
You know, like I think that's what would be the sequel, is bringing him back and him sort of taking over. And you know, let's talk about the ending since we're kind of at that anyway. The Detective Cortez tracking him down, and over the course of the story, eventually, Gray thinks that it's the head of the corporation, Aaron Keane, who's manipulated everything and used him as an experiment. But you find out that even the Keane is not in control, and the computer stem is even controlling him. And it's all because the computer stem wants basically to be human. And you have this kind of interesting juxtaposition where people are upgrading themselves to try to become more like machines, and you sort of admire everything the technology does. And then you have an artificial intelligence, and all it really wants is to be a human. And one reason why it focuses on him is because he doesn't have any implants or technology in him. He just wants to be totally human. And he ultimately locks Gray inside this dream state, inside his own brain where it feels like he wakes up from an accident and his wife's there and everything's okay. And it's like, you did a side by side on Twitter with the ending of Brazil, and it's a lot like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not an out of nowhere twist. You know, it doesn't feel like they're just trying to get one up on you. Like, it actually builds up to that. You know, when he's at the hacker's place, you have all these people who are plugged into virtual reality, and they talk about, well, maybe the fantasy world, it's not as painful as the real world, and maybe, you know, that's why people would want to spend days and months. And, you know, you think about people who spend a lot of time playing, like, online games and sort of falling into that world where you can play for, like, hours and hours at a time without coming up for air. And, you know, it's not such a huge stretch to understand why somebody would want to be in a virtual state for a long period of time. Like, you know, it's sort of going back to the idea of the Matrix, or, you know, in the film The Matrix, the Cypher character wanting to go back into the Matrix and be plugged back in and,
sure,
you know, just forget. Like, it's a little bit like that. And I thought it was sort of weird that Lee Winnell was in the Matrix sequels, like, as an actor.
Yeah, I didn't actually even know that until you text me that, like, a few days ago. But, I think that makes total sense.
I guess the Matrix sequels were filmed in Australia, and he's Australian. Right.
There you go.
He sort of came up with James Wan, and he was like, I know he acted in Saw in addition to being the co-writer, but I didn't really think of him as an actor. But I guess, I haven't seen the Matrix sequels for a long time, but he's the kid who, I thought the character was, like, a little bit annoying when he's sort of tagging along with the new crew on the hover ship. But, you can just sort of picture him being there on set with the Wachowskis and sort of thinking about these ideas. And I don't know if maybe the origins for Upgrade, if they were already going back to that point in time. I don't know how long he was thinking of this story and sort of thinking through the ideas, but
I feel like there'd have to be. The Matrix is huge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I was in college when the sequels came out, and I remember I saw both of them in the theater. And honestly, I haven't seen either one since.
But it's been a long time. Yeah.
I mean, but also it's also that addition to I'll just reiterate what you said with Joe Pantoliano's character about, like, he's in this world, he just wants to get out, and that's kind of that. Like, the movie ends, but it does give you, like, that specific Brazil moment where it's like he thinks he's with his wife in the hospital and blah blah blah. And I'm still thinking about what you said about, like, I like the ambition. I like your idea of the sequel. It's just like it seems similar to mine, just with an additional kind of thing tacked on. I feel like it almost,
I feel like my
do
tacked on thing would be like the very end. Like that wouldn't happen until like the last 10 minutes or something. But,
oh, of course. Well, I was thinking more than 10 minutes, but it's still like a big thing where just like, you know, now essentially it's like a combination of like the way they had to lock into stuff in order for the robots to work in the first Pacific Rim, and a bit of the Inception and Inception, where now like they're both in these worlds and they have to take each other out. And because the messed up thing is now, you know, Logan Marshall Green's character, the vessel, he's actually not bad at all, but now he's, and it would just suck for this to end with him being, if they do a sequel, it would suck if he ended, you know, being the villain, you know, at the end of the day. It's like he kind of, his name has to be cleared to some degree. And I just think, you know, also the whole idea of, and even just like making new villains or sub-villains is pretty easy, because it's funny. So a couple weeks ago, I've been slowly trying to finish up season 2 of The Punisher.
Right.
And then as I'm watching, when I'm getting, where I'm at now, I haven't watched in a couple of days, but the whole story arc where Jigsaw is like assembling these former soldiers to kind of be his army. And I remember being like, what does this remind me of? It's like, oh, this is like Upgrade, because all those guys were like former, you know, quote, soldiers. So it's just kind of like, unfortunately, especially just in America alone, there's a lot of people who don't come back from war or who come back, you know, with PTSD. So there's just like an assembly line of potential new vessels to be kind of like, you know, because I imagine that like Logan Marshall Green / you know, the robot version of himself is intelligent,
right,
and he needs to assemble some henchmen or an army, just like, you know, the little dude who looks just like Kelly from Bad News Bears, the villain, except with a mustache. So it's again, it's all there. I even almost, this sounds messed up, but I feel like a sequel. I almost want the sequel to be direct to video, similar to like Man with the Iron Fist was, because at least you know if it goes direct to video or you know VOD or streaming, the budget is already going to be constrained. I honestly, I'm not trying to sound all naive and corny, but I feel like if the ideas are good and innovative, what little budget you have isn't going to stifle that. And when I say little budget, I'm sure they can get a few million. You know what I mean? Like, there's plenty of streaming and VOD movies that you know could do that. So yeah, I'm holding out for that. I just know. Oh, I forgot her name. The actress who's in, she's in all the Blumhouse movies. The Detective Cortez.
Oh, yeah, she was in Get Out. Yeah. Betty Gabriel.
Yeah, she's just in such high demand, so she's pretty busy, so I don't know.
I mean, it would be cool to have her as more the main character, the main protagonist. Like, in this, she's a major player, but she's not quite at the center of the story, and she's almost, like, one step behind for a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be interesting to have her, you know, in more of the forefront and give her a chance to show off as the lead of a film, you know. But like the dark nature of the ending, I think in some ways it's a perfect ending because it's dark in that he gets exactly what he wants. Gray gets really what he wants. He sort of opts out and he goes into this fantasy world, even though he kind of,
that is true,
like it's dark because we have some sort of perspective on it. But you know, for that character, he's in some ways it's a happy ending for him, and that kind of complication of it is one thing I like about it, because, I mean, I was thinking a little bit of the I guess now it's a Netflix show, the Black Mirror, and, I think, like, there's some really good episodes, but a lot of it just kind of has the same sort of arc and same sort of comment on technology, and I feel like, in contrast, Upgrade, it's something a little bit more nuanced than, oh, you know, technology's secretly evil. Like, I think in some ways, it's saying, you know, technology can give us exactly what we want, but there's going to be a price for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of introduces this idea, like, again, comparing it to The Matrix.
Yeah.
Like, in The Matrix, the machines take over, or The Terminator, the machines take over sort of violently. In this, it's more nuanced, where it's like the machines will persuade us and we'll just give up more and more control over to them. And that's how machines will take over our lives, you know. At the beginning, when he's talking with the wife, you know, when they're in the, I think it's when they're in the self-driving car, and she says, he says, what will you do when the machines take over everything? She said, well, you know, sit back and enjoy the ride. And that's kind of what happens with this film.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
It's not like the machine ever has to be, you know, at one point he's sort of resisting it at the end, but it's like this, devilish persuasion that I find kind of makes it interesting, you know, this idea that like we do give more control to our technology of our lives almost without thinking about it, because we like giving up this control. We like what technology can do, and it's just, you know, you sort of have to stop and think if it comes at the expense of certain freedoms or certain...
God, man, I don't want to, like, be all cliche and talk about, oh, the iPhone or like tablet phones or whatever, but it's like, I'm 50-50 in that. I have to be... I love my phone. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
Between, like, just, like, the music. I can listen to music while making movie comparisons and writing my latest review on it, like, all at the same time on this little thing. Well, I have the larger version of the phone. But then there's other times where, like, you know, I have the Touch ID thing. And if, like, I don't know, I was sweating or there's something on my finger or it doesn't recognize it, it won't let me... And then, like... I'll be saying, I'm like, let me in my fucking, this is my phone, let me in. You know, it is this weird thing where it's like, it doesn't recognize your ID. What are you talking about? It's me. Let me in my phone. Or the other thing too, like, it gives you like a certain amount of tries and then you get locked out and it's just like, my stuff is in here. It's just like I have like, you know, like Apple Pay and like some information. I want to get to it when I want to get to it. And it's just like, it kind of, and it's that, it's this inanimate object that's not letting you do something, and you associate it with the stiffness and the sternness of how, like, I'm sorry, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't do that. Similar to going back to, like, you know, just before, you know, Gray Trace and his wife die, they're in the car, and he's like, slow down. like, you know, take, you're going the wrong route, take this route, and it's just totally disregarding. Can't do anything about it.
I mean, they always say how planes are much safer than driving, right? Like, people die driving all the time, but I think, you know, like, I remember when that that German pilot crashed the plane into a mountain on purpose, and it's like,
what was this,
you know, a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, what I always think is, like, scary about being in an airplane is you're not the one with the control. Like, if I crash a car, it's me crashing the car. But, you know, if you're in an airplane, like, you don't know what's going on up there. Like, that's sort of the scary part of it. And I'm not trying to say one is, like, I'm not trying to say don't fly. Like, of course, fly. It's great. It's convenient. It's safe. But understanding that thought process of, like, hey, like, I have zero control over myself for the next 8 hours.
Yeah.
You know, it's scary. And, like, I think, you know, in some ways, technology, it might not be life or death, but that kind of lack of control that seems to come up a lot, you know. I mean, there's one scene in the film, like, after he's been completely paralyzed, when he's taking the painkiller and he's trying to
he's trying to overdose, basically.
He's trying to overdose because he just wants to die. And, like, you can see the thought process, like, again, his performance is really great, where he's just sort of, you know, he starts asking it to do it again, and then the machine stops. It's like, no, you've
right,
you know, this is, like, exceeded your amount or whatever it says. And, like, I could completely see something like that happening. And
that's so funny you say that, because it's like, I've been dealing with, so less than 3 months ago, I started a new design job. And, you know, so you don't go on your company's healthcare plan until, like, that 3 month period. So I've been paying for Cobra, and it's just even little stuff, like when I go to the pharmacy and I try to refill a prescription, and then it's like, there's that non-human element where, like, the pharmacist is looking up on the computer and they're just like, oh, you're granted this many pills for this thing. And it's like, what if I need more? And it's just like, and they're like, I don't know, the computer's not letting me do anything. You know, like, that's right. Literally what they say. It's like, they say you get 30 pills, you get 30 pills. I can't do anything about it. And it's just this, like, whoa, that's, wow. Yeah.
Right. Hey, we have this idea that the computers are somewhat infallible. Like, oh, if your name's on the list, or, you know, say you get pulled over and they say, oh, your name's in the system, you know, because some cop trusts the computer, you might get arrested even though it's mixing your name up with somebody else. Or you hear, like, people being put on the no-fly list because they have the same name as somebody else. Like, computers, you know, make mistakes all the time, or, you know, at least they sort of correspond with, you know, human errors depending what's put into them. But, like,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, even this episode, we're plagued by crashing laptop issues.
Yeah,
so,
tell me about it, yeah.
You know, and, I've yelled at my computer like it's a, you know, living thing for freezing up or for doing whatever. You know, you get actually, like, emotional over this thing that's not really alive. So, like, it's a strange relationship that I think the film taps into in a really clever way. And, you know, taking these situations where, at the you know, after the crash and he's paralyzed, like, he has no control over anything, you know, he's a complete quadriplegic, and then sort of the freedom that comes with the technology, and then eventually he sort of ends up back to that place where he has no control over anything, he's like a prisoner in his own mind. It's interesting, you know. I find it, the film, it's smart about how it explores this relationship between us and technology. It's not just the old demonization of it.
Yeah, and just and also a combination of just like, hey, this is what you wanted, so this is what happens, kind of thing. It's funny too, going back to your Black Mirror comment. There, it is Black Mirror-esque. Even the ending, to some degree,
it's an ironic twist. It's
Like, I was gonna say, I remember a while ago, I had this. This was like maybe 2 years ago. I had this tweet about, like, I'm really enjoying Black Mirror, but 2/3 of every episode ends like, oh, just kidding, it was just like a Truman Show style thing, and or was it? And then it ends. It really is. But at the same time, I really do love Black Mirror, but I guess it's a testament to how much I do really enjoy that show, because I really feel like I'm being pretty accurate where 2/3 of every episode ends where it's just like, oh, sorry, you're just kidding, this wasn't real, or is it? But you're stuck in the machine and you can't get out, like, kind of.
Yeah, I think especially lately, like the newer seasons, like when it was still a BBC show.
Yeah.
Like those were really good. Like, I mean, you know, what show could have ever predicted that, like, a prime minister was a pig fucker? Like, that's sort of weird also, and specific.
I think that, yeah, the pig, that's when I was like, oh, it's just it's social commentary on our voyeuristic nature and ever. But it was still really like, but it's just like pig fucking, though. That's crazy.
But it turned out to be true. Yeah, like, that was the craziest part.
Right. And I also feel like, also, I think the most genius element of Black was in the not this most recent Balderdash, whatever you call it. Actually, I haven't watched it, but the season before, the season finale, Black Museum.
Oh yeah,
but the specific arc about the doctor who like got off on feeling pain.
Yeah,
that's like wasn't that it's predicted like the David, by? It's the David Cronenberg movie that like we never got.
Right.
It really like early David Cronenberg movie that we never got. What were you about to say? You said someone predicted that?
I think Carl Pilkington, who's on the Ricky Gervais shows, he did, like, The Idiot Abroad. There's, like, some clip from podcast where he's, like, just coming up with ideas for movies that sound really dumb, but, like, half of them turn into Black Mirror episodes.
That's hilarious.
So, wow. I think it was one like that, where he's like, oh, wouldn't it be great if, like, there was a movie about a doctor who could feel what his patient felt? And they're like, that's dumb. And like, Ricky Gervais just yells him down. But it ended up being a Black Mirror episode. So I don't know.
Wow.
My favorite episode of Black Mirror, it's with the, I think it's called A Million Merits with Daniel Kaluuya, who was, of course, in the Get Out. So there's a little bit of a Blumhouse connection. But like, that one.
Oh, that was good. I like that one. Yeah.
That one's really good. Like, one thing I like about that one is it's not as focused on the technology. It's this like terrifying click app, you have to watch this ad to like use your free app kind of dystopia, but like it's more about you know, like how things get co-opted, like even our own outrage can get co-opted and commercialized and sort of sold back to us. Like, you know, I kind of like when, you know, it didn't fall into that mold of technology's bad, maybe you're trapped in a computer program kind of thing that it seems to have been stuck on lately.
Sure.
You know, and I think it helps for Upgrade that it's not ambiguous about the ending. You know, for half a moment I'm like, I think watching the first time I thought, oh, is it going to be like all a dream or, you know, something, but then it makes it pretty definitive what happened. And I think if it had gone for a more ambiguous ending, it might have felt sloppier actually. Like it has a very specific point that it's making with all this.
And then it goes back to what you said. If there's a sequel, even direct-to-video, give them the same budget. You know, I remember a mutual friend of ours, I'll leave him nameless, was working on a film. This was years ago, and I was appearing on a podcast. My friend Warren, he used to have a podcast, and I was saying, like, man, he's putting the finishing touches on, like, pre-production. I hope he gets all the money in the world. And it's such a throwaway line. But then Warren was just like, no, he should get the money that he needs in order to make the film, not like, eight digits, you know, or whatever, like he should get the money that, you know, that he needs. And, you know, cause this brings me to, our Danish guy, Lars von Trier, in the sense that like, I've always liked a lot of his movies. I think almost every movie,
the restrictions,
even outside of Dogma, whether it's in the plot, whether it's the execution, the backstory behind it, there's always, you know, a restriction. And
I mean, Five Obstructions is sort of the ultimate kind of exploration of that.
Yeah, but even Epidemic, which is like that's kind of the one. No, actually, you know what? I take that back, because Element of Crime at least has a Criterion release. Epidemic is never really brought up, and to some degree, I get it. It's not like an amazing movie. But just the whole point behind that movie was him, you know, and his screenwriter buddy, who's actually in the film. He's like, he's the other guy. They were just sitting around one day, and they were just talking about whatever. And he's like, you can't make a horror movie for $100,000. And Lars von Trier was like, yeah, I'm sure you can. And that's how the movie got made. The budget for that movie was just a little over $100,000 US. And and that was the genesis of that project.
The creative solutions that we mentioned at the beginning of this episode are part of what I think makes Upgrade stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Like you talked a little bit about it, but the idea that it's focused on him, it's centered on him. And I think what they said, they used like a iPod in the pocket or a iPhone, and it was like synced up with the camera with some kind of motion tracking. So the camera would just motion track Logan Marshall Green as he's fighting. And
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a, like, the effect it has, it's a little bit like, I don't know if listeners know Polcam, where you put the monopod with the camera on it and the actor holds it in front of their face while they're running, so it's like their face stays, you know, perfect and the whole background's moving around. And...
Oh, it's almost, well, I mean, there's a lot of shots like that, or movies, yeah, rather, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's one great moment in the Upgrade when he does like a somersault and the whole room's spinning around, but he's just perfectly in the center of the frame and it looks like he's not moving, just the world around him's moving.
Yeah.
And how that emphasizes the artificiality of how he's fighting. And, you know, it makes it feel like very inhuman, the motion of it. It sort of adds to this idea that it's like a robot controlling him. And, you know, again, thinking of the Matrix, just like how... Like the Matrix, those famous bullet time shots, you know, Trinity jumping up in the air and the camera spinning around. It's like, you know, how do we play with time and motion in these action scenes to kind of express something? It sort of feels like maybe Lee Winnell was just like sitting around thinking, how do I do something different with this action that actually says something? I feel like that's sort of the important part, is it doesn't just feel like it's thrown in there because it's cool. It actually serves a purpose. Same with a lot of the stylistic choices. Like, there's a lot of neon lighting in the film.
Yeah.
And, like, on one hand, it's kind of a, you know, you alluded to RoboCop and Terminator, and it's kind of an 80s throwback-ish, but it's not exactly like a film like The Guest, where it just feels like an aesthetic throwback. It's more just in the vein of those types of films.
Yeah.
And the lighting that comes along with that, you know, it doesn't feel totally self-conscious. It just feels like, you know, this neon lighting and, you know, pinks and reds and orange and greens, they just feel very unnatural, and it kind of adds to the sense that this world is sort of removed from the natural world. It's a very artificial world, and like it serves a thematic purpose. I'm like, oh, like it's not just because, hey, neon's cool and it's 80s and 80s are back in style now, thing that some movies do.
And again, I have to go back. The score, like, whenever I listen to the score, I mean, whatever, I obviously saw the movie before I listened to the score, so I'm going to be influenced, but, like, every song reminds me of just, like, you know, neon red, neon pink, like, just, like the synth notes that, you know, Jed Taylor uses.
Yeah.
I just can visualize. I was walking to the train from work today listening to the score, and I was just, like, I could just kind of almost see those, I could feel the colors, rather.
Yeah.
The two really go hand in hand and complement each other.
But it's not self-conscious the way, like, some, hey, this is, like, a retro John Carpenter-style type films.
Sure.
Like, that's one thing I like, again, about the film. It's, on one hand, it wears its influences on its sleeve. It's no secret that it's, you know, influenced by Verhoeven and Cronenberg and James Cameron. But it also feels fresh and creative, and it's not just sitting on its influences. It's actually, you know, how can we take this forward? You know, there's things that it reminded me of Metropolis, and it just feels very aware of this history of, you know, science fiction films, specifically films that explore our relationship with technology. And it's very in tune with its own, you know, genre history at the same time as maybe offering a few new things and kind of building on that and doing a good, you know, and being an exceptional example of it at the same time.
Sure. That was a great comparison you made, by the way. The,
the hand.
Yeah. That was great.
Yeah. There was one shot I tried to go back and find it, but it's like when he's got these geometric patterns, it's like Metropolis when she's got the star behind her, the robot, and, you know, but like just in a thematic sense, like this idea of how technology is going to change the way we work and live and impact our lives, like that, you know, that's not a new theme.
Sure.
You know, going back to the silent era of film, obviously. But, you know, it's still a relevant theme, and it's still a theme that you can kind of find new ways to connect to the way we live now. Like a lot of science fiction, you know, I think people sort of make the mistake of thinking that all science fiction needs to be predictive. You know, people were saying like, oh, it's 2019. Like, look how wrong Blade Runner is. We're not living in flying cars. I think like that's sort of a very surface and, you know, silly kind of way of interpreting these science fiction films or trying to find value in them. Like, you know, Blade Runner, the point is it's about the present, and like if anything it's like a stylistic throwback. You know, it's noir, it's not meant to be, hey, this is what the future will look like. You know, I think Upgrade, it's, you know, again, there are some things where, hey, I could picture that in the near future, and it's not so outlandish, a lot of the ideas, but it's...
Not at all, yeah.
You know, but, like, I think really it's a film about today, and, like, some of the stuff, you know, with the talking voice in the house, I was thinking how futuristic that is, and then I sort of remembered, like, people have Alexa in their home now, or whatever that is. Like,
and then again,
like,
sometimes and sometimes that screws up, where it's just like, Alexa, do this. No, not that song. Or, like, no, that's not the function I said, you know?
What happens when those types of mistakes come down to something that, like, really, really matters, you know?
Yeah.
If you have self-driving cars, like, hey, Alexa, go pick up my kid from school, and it goes three states over, you know? Like, it's gonna happen, and I don't know. It's just something to consider as we move forward. I mean, I can't wait for the days when self-driving cars are all over the place. I don't like driving at all, so that'd be good for me.
As someone who drives quite a bit, I prefer to be in control, I'm gonna be honest. But not just myself, but everyone. I need to be on the road with everybody on the same playing field, because that also worries me too. A combination, again, it just goes back to this laptop or just having too many things open, where it's just like a combination of human and machine, and then it's just like, and then there's just like too much of a conflict, and then there's literal crashes on, like, you know, my laptop crash, which just kept happening earlier.
Right. And, like, there's things that the film does that feel very, you know, close to things that are happening now socially too. Like, I was thinking about the hacker talking about, like, I mean, they don't really go into it too much, but they mention that they're don't even guess my gender, I think they say, and they're sort of this non-binary person, and that's, like, you know, you wouldn't really see that in the Terminator. Like, it just feels as if, you know, this is something that's a little bit more aware of what's going on now, technology-wise, socially-wise. It's just, you know, it's not trying to be a throwback, you know, in those ways. Like, you know, some science fiction stuff now, it's sort of embracing the retro-futurism. Like, you know, there's a video game coming out, Cyberpunk something, where it's like 80s style cyberpunk still. And, you know, I was thinking, like, you know, Blade Runner's, how old is Blade Runner?
1987. Yeah.
Jeez. So, like, Blade Runner is like 37 years old. It feels like there should be something fresh or new, you know, to see people kind of still recycling some of those images and ideas. It's like, you know, Blade Runner's great, but I think to see new films kind of falling back on stuff like that for cyberpunk, it could feel a little bit stale, you know? So I like Upgrade. It just finds a way to kind of build on Blade Runner and stuff like that in a way that doesn't feel like it's trying to imitate it.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man.
I was wondering if you want to talk a little bit about the villains.
Yeah. I was waiting to get to that. Yeah. It's, you know, in a weird roundabout way, the villain, kind of, like, I'm talking about the mercenary villain who you know, who he has to fight.
I think his name's Fisk something.
Benedict
Fisk, Hardy character. Fisk. Yeah.
In a way, he's such a weird, unconventional villain. It almost, not at all, but at the same time reminded me of Craig Burko in Long Kiss Goodnight, where it's just like,
okay,
this is a weird choice for a villain. Because I remember, because when I was a kid and I was watching Long Kiss Goodnight, he was so polite.
Yeah.
And in this one, he's also polite too. But essentially, I'm not trying to be this guy because I'm a somewhat large guy. But he's such a twerp.
Essentially. He is. He's a dweeb.
Yeah, he's a dweeb. He's a lot. He's a dweeb. He's kind of a shrimp. And then, but he still even though I said he still pulls it off. Like he's still
the attitude. Like,
exactly. Yeah, like, it's all about attitude. Exactly. There you go.
You know, he has this superiority complex, you know, is this idea that because he's got these technological implants, it's like he's above human beings, like regular people.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, maybe it was just the way I was reading it, but, like, I thought that there's, like, definitely sort of, like, a racist subtext to just the way he interacts with these other people. And, like, what does he say to the bartender right as he kills him? Like, let my superiority over your kind be the last thought that crosses it before machines chew up your brain or something you know, there's this idea that, like, he thinks of himself as, you know, not just different, but sort of superior to people. And, like,
I'd say
something
so.
About,
I'd say so.
I think so. Like, you know, it's just part of the film's subtext or part of that character's subtext. And, like,
well, his hairdo and that mustache does kind of make him look like a Hitler youth. I mean,
he looks
a little Third Reichish.
or even like some of these like alt-right kind of guys mm-hmm. who are trying to look Third Reichish, like something about this skinny guy
or a Proud Boy, like one of the Proud Boys.
Right, he looks like a Proud Boy, exactly. Like the mustache, you know, everything. Like, to me, he evokes that more than like the traditional kind of like Nazi bad guy.
Sure.
Like it would have been easy to write him as like, oh, biggest guy in the room, tough, whatever, but the fact that he's like this,
I agree,
weak-looking guy who goes around like he's got the biggest dick in the room kind of makes him really hateable, you know? So, no, he's really great as a villain, I think. Yeah. And, like, the other character who's kind of a villain...
The Elon Musk guy.
The Elon Musk type guy.
Yeah.
I kind of like also just the choice to make him really socially awkward. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one part where he's interacting with the wife at the beginning, and... Like, he's rude in the way that somebody not realizing that they're rude can be, you know? Like, he just seems like he doesn't interact with people and doesn't have those, like, the ability to read those social cues. I forget what he says. You know, she's talking about her company, like, hey, we're not there yet, but we're getting there. And he's like, no, you're not. And just says it, you know, in a sort of matter-of-fact way that, you know, sometimes you see, like, Elon Musk going like on a Twitter rant or something, and it just seems really out of touch and weird. Like I think it's tapping into that a little bit.
Sure.
So, funny. And I guess the third villain ends up being Stan, which I like for a while. It kind of falls into the sort of buddy action movie type thing.
Oh, with the two of them. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Like, and that stuff's so entertaining. Yeah. Like I mean, the whole film's really enjoyable, but that's. Like, for a film that has a pretty dark tone overall, that's where it finds some levity and some, like, playfulness, you know, in the fact that, oh, one can do something, like, it's making his body do all these incredible things, but then he knows how to pick the lock.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
You know, like, it's like the classic kind of odd couple buddy action thing, which just, I mean, it also sort of fits into the revenge movie mold where it's, like, the guy closest to you ends up being the one to betray you, and, you mentioned HAL from 2001. Like, that's totally the voice. What it's going for is that HAL 9000 personality, I guess you could say.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
But, like, a lot of their little interactions are really fantastic, I find. Like, you know, when he says, oh, I'm a ninja, and it's like, while I'm state-of-the-art, I am not a ninja. Yeah, like, it's pretty funny. Or there's one part where they're copying the tattoo from one of the guys as they're tracking it down, and it's like a barcode with a serial number,
mm-hmm.
and you just see the hand writing it out as if it's a printer.
Wait, so I'm, you know, say that again.
Like you see, like Stem's taking control to like copy down the tattoo, which is like this circular barcode with a serial number around it, and it copies it out like the way a printer works, line by line. It's really unusual, and you know, just sort of those little details, kind of thinking how a computer would interact with a person, and sort of, you know, giving you those unexpected things. It's something I appreciated.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marcus, for being the voice inside my head for this episode of the podcast. And if folks want to find you online, or if there's anything they should check out, where can they look?
Yeah, go to check out PinlandEmpire.com. Check out Zebras in America. It's a podcast that I do with my friend and film score composer, Scott Thoreau. Go to The Pink Smoke. There's a lot of my years and years, almost at this point, we're getting close to a decade's worth of stuff that I've done for The Pink Smoke. Go to Wrong Reel, check out the FlixWise back catalog, and as far as all the other various podcast appearances I've done, if you just go to PinlandEmpire.com, that's kind of the main hub where you can just kind of find all the outer non-Pinland Empire stuff that I've done also. So check all that stuff out. Like I said, just weekly, go, you know, the rest of this month, March, April, I'll just be posting stuff up regularly. I have some things cooking for some other sites that just haven't been posted up yet, but yeah.
Cool. That sounds good. It's a good idea to keep all your appearances in one place, because I've
got
them all spread out now. I lose track of where I've been, but
yeah.
If folks want to follow me, I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The show's at FlixWise on Twitter, FlixWise.com. There's a Facebook, there's, you know, all that stuff. And until next time, listeners, take care and be wary of those self-driving cars. Bye.